Give me your name, please.
Okay, it's Michael George Fitting.
And your birthplace?
I was born in Sharon, at Sharon Hospital.
Your birthdate?
My birthday is April 14th, 1950.
And your parents' names?
My father's George Edwin Fitting, and my mother's name is Polly Martin Fitting.
And do you have siblings?
Yes, I have an older brother, Peter Martin Fitting, and a younger brother, Jeffrey Thomas Fitting.
And your education?
I went to Salisbury Central School, and then I went to Oliver Wilcott Technical School for high school.
Thank you. I'm sorry, that was it. So much.
And she became a librarian in North Canaan as a librarian, and for a long time, probably 40 years. Maybe that's exaggerated. I never did keep track.
How about your father? What did he do for a living?
My father was a carpenter, a contractor. He actually did carpentry work, and I always understood that my grandfather, Jake Fitting, his father, was all ready to think about retiring and let my father take over. And when my father was killed in a car accident.
And I think that you said that your father was killed in an accident coming back from where?
The accident was on Under Mountain Road, north in Sheffield. But he had been spent the day. It's when they opened up Lamrock Racetrack, and he'd been down there to see Walter Cronkite, who was there for the opening of Lamrock Racetrack. And it was sometime that evening he was riding with a gentleman, with another guy, and there was a bad accident, and he was killed because he had a seatbelt on.
And I think you said that your mother never wore her seatbelt after that.
That's right. My mother would never wear a seatbelt. I do. I've been witness to numerous accidents, and I've actually been involved in accidents myself where we didn't get hurt, the guy I was with, because we didn't have them on, and the people that in the other vehicle didn't get hurt because they did have them on. So
you never know.
You don't know.
You never know. I'm going to ask you some things about growing up in Salisbury. Like, where did you play?
Well, there was a few of us around town. We'd get together, and a lot of times we'd rally, and there was a field off the cemetery, the Protestant cemetery, that we used to play football on and baseball on. Sorry about that. That was my fire company pager making some racket.
Okay. Now, we're talking about the big cemetery, not the one behind the town hall, but the big cemetery.
The big cemetery,
between
yes.
Between 41 and 44.
That is correct.
Okay.
And not the one that's off the Cobble Road is actually the Catholic cemetery.
Yes.
So they sort of almost connect now because the big cemetery has expanded, and there's actually some grave sites in the field where we used to play ball all the time. But a lot of times we met there, and then we also gathered together. It was always a custom to meet at the drugstore, and the Salisbury Pharmacy had a big concrete stoop in the front, and we would, after school or whatever, we'd go in and get an ice cream or candy bar or whatever, and we'd all hang out there, and numerous times Anna would come running out and, come on, you kids, get out of here, keeping people from coming into the stores. We'd just hang out in front of the drugstore.
You've got a relation with somebody that worked at the Salisbury Pharmacy. The Whitbecks.
Well, yes, the Whitbecks. Well, Lois Whitbeck was actually my mother's sister. She was my aunt.
Okay.
So that's connected with the family in that way.
Lois Whitbeck was married to?
To Sam Whitbeck.
To Sam Whitbeck. Okay.
Yep.
And you told me about root beer floats. You said those were pretty good.
Well, yeah, the best root beer floats around we used to get at the drugstore, we always called it. And Anna would make them up, and Anna or Walt, they would always make up the best root beer floats, and with the frosted, and best frosted mugs for the root beer, so it was renowned on how good their root beer was, and we always look forward to that.
Do you remember how much they cost? A nickel?
No, I'm thinking it was 25 cents.
That could be.
It was 25 cents, but I don't really remember.
Did you ever play in a band?
Yes. excuse me. When I was in high school, a few friends of mine and myself got together, and we created a rock and roll band. And we started out with four of us, and then we added some, and then some were dropped, and we actually played in quite a few different gigs around here. We expanded, and we played, and we went to, I guess, to the high school in Great Barrington. We played up there.
That would be Searles.
Searles High School. We played at, moved down to Kent. We actually ended up going to Yale University because we had some good I had some good friends down there, and we got to play in a couple gigs down there. And then we actually did a few up in Pownall, Vermont, or Bennington, Vermont, because of a relationship that my mom had with a guy, Dick Cleveland, who she went out with.
Richard Cleveland, isn't it?
And that's Dick Cleveland, Richard Cleveland from Salisbury. Mm-hmm. He actually took my mom out before she married my father, so there was...
So it was a connection.
There was an old connection there, and so we actually traveled around quite a bit to play in different places. So.
Oh, good. Who were the four originals?
Originally, it was my brother Peter, Gary Smith, Alan Jones, and myself. And then we brought on Dale Palmer, and then Mel Brickman, and then so as the band changed its venue, I guess you will, some dropped. Both Gary Smith and my brother Peter were let go, if you will, and it ended up being Dale and Alan and Mel Brickman and myself.
Was Mel Brickman the son of Morris Brickman?
Yes, he was. Yeah.
Do you remember a recreation director by the name of Mr. Hemmerly?
Oh, yes, yeah.
What can you tell me about him?
Wilbur Hemmerly. I remember when we played midget league baseball, and then also midget league basketball. So a couple of different sports got involved with him on Hem was around all the time. And, of course, he was older than me, and, you know, probably like I am now. But
that's not old. That's not old. Was he good at what he did?
You know, I'm really too young to remember that.
Okay.
So I can't really expound on that at all.
But. All right. I'll get somebody a little older than you. Now I'm going to switch to the Congregational Church.
Alrighty.
Ministers that you remember of the Congregational Church?
So, I remember Lawrence Stone, Larry Stone. Mm-hmm. He was a minister when I was going through Sunday school. And actually, when we went to Sunday school, we used to have to come out of the back of the church building. It's where the assembly hall is now. We used to come out, and there's another house that sat there, and we had Sunday school. I remember the second floor up in that house. So Larry Stone was the first minister I remember. And so then after Sunday school, then I sort of separated from the church for a while, you know, through teenage years and then into my young adulthood. And I didn't really get active with it until I came back after I got married and my kids started going to Sunday school. And then I got involved in the church more and I've been...
When would that be? What... Approximate years?
Well, probably 26, 28 years ago.
Okay.
My oldest daughter is 28, so maybe a little less, maybe 25 years ago.
Okay. Now, I think you said that Helen Stone was the organist when her husband was the minister.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Who followed Mr. Stone? Do you remember?
I don't, but there's a whole...
There's a whole list, I know.
And the pictures are down now because they're renovating the back of the hall, but there's pictures of all the ministers at the church.
Okay.
So I'll get mixed up with order they're in. So I
remember Dick Tabor, and of course you would remember Dick Tabor.
Right.
And Al Sly is the organist now.
That's correct.
Okay, and then you've had a couple of interims, and now you've got a lady minister.
Yes. I think... I actually think Al Sly was an organist right after Helen Stone. I don't think there was another organist in between.
I don't think so either, unless there was an interim.
Right.
Because he's been there a long time.
Yeah, I don't think so. He actually just joined the church recently because he actually belonged to the Episcopal Church.
Yes, he was a member of St. John's. Right. What are some of the positions that you've held in the church when you came back?
Well, when I came back, I got active with the on the ushers committee, mm-hmm. and that, so I served on that. And part of the understanding or of being on committees is you serve like 2-3 year terms, and so I served on the ushers for 6 years, and then I was asked to fill in to complete a term on the board of deacons, mm-hmm. So that was for 2 years, and then I was on for another 6 years after that. Then I served on the Christian Action Committee for a term of 3 years, and then went back on the Board of Deacons again for another 6 years.
You've been busy.
So, yeah.
But it's a very active church.
Yes, it is.
A very active church.
And I feel we're blessed now because our new pastor, Reverend Diane Montecatania, she's a real
she's
active
excellent.
With the kids, you know, mm-hmm. and the youth is what's going to keep the church alive, and we have to be able to be with them.
Yes.
And hopefully guide them down the right paths. And,
yeah.
I mean, I'm fortunate. I wandered away from the church, but I didn't wander away in a bad way. Life got in the way.
You had good background and good training.
Yep.
You had very good training, and you don't lose that. It may be in abeyance for a while, but you don't lose it. You don't lose it. Are you involved at all in the Fall Festival specifically, or is it connected with the church, whatever you do for the Fall Festival?
Well, yes, I'm active with it in that they call it coordinator.
Okay.
I'm not the person in charge, but I'm fortunate to have a position where I can take time off and run around and get stuff just put in place so the thing pulls off right. Mm-hmm. Getting proper signs up, making connections with disposal of garbage, and just arranging all the stuff that's done behind the scenes of any function that, you know, somebody
and
has to do.
There's a lot more to that than people realize unless they're involved with it.
That's right.
Absolutely. Now I'm going to switch to the Masonic Lodge. Tell me about the history as much as you know. When did it start, and who signed the charter?
Okay, yeah, great. So we're talking about Montgomery Lodge number 13. Ancient, free, and accepted Masons in Lakeville, Connecticut. And Montgomery Lodge was founded by the Grand Lodge of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Our charter was originally signed by Paul Revere, who was senior Grand Warden in Massachusetts at the time. That was in 1783. And the way the charter read is that we would operate under the rules and regulations of the Most Worshipful Grand Lodge of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, until Connecticut appointed its own Grand Master and formed its own Grand Lodge. So I was fortunate to be master. The first time I was master of the lodge was our 200th anniversary. We had a procession down Main Street in Lakeville. We had a lot of the lodges attended from a wide range of people, a wide area, as well as the Sphinx Temple Motor Patrol. Little cars ran down. Mm-hmm. And so we had a procession down Main Street, and we had permission. We all congregated at the end of the procession at Bicentennial Park, and we had permission to put a copy of our charter in a time capsule.
Oh, excellent.
And so we actually had somebody from the deputy grand master from Massachusetts was there, and we had somebody write in representing Paul Revere, and he handed a copy of the charter to the deputy grand master of Massachusetts, and he turned it over to the grand master of Connecticut, who presented it to me, and we were able to place it in a time capsule.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And so we have it written that it won't be open till the next 100 years. It'll be interesting to see if that goes on or not. But
well, neither one of us will be around to see that.
I plan to be.
Oh, all right. If you're there, I'll be there.
Okay. That's quite a bit of history. We're fortunate. But a bit of that same history. Now, that was the 200th anniversary. Mm-hmm. When Montgomery Lodge held its 100th anniversary in 1883, they actually ran special trains into Lakeville to bring Masons to this ceremony. They set up place servings to serve 2,500 people.
Ooh, my.
And they changed it three times. So there's history. They served over 7,500 people
Good.
For the 100th Good. Anniversary of Montgomery Lodge in 1883.
Wow.
So that's a, of course, things are different nowadays, and there's other vices out there that drop people away, but we were fortunate. We probably had a couple hundred people for our ceremonies on the 200th anniversary, which is a good turnout, too.
So. Yes. And you were also Grand Mason for the 225th, I think.
Oh, excuse me. So, no, that was not, it's not Grand Mason. No. I was actually I've been Master of Montgomery Lodge six times, and the last time was our 225th anniversary. So we, again, it wasn't as much of a public event as we tried to make the 200th, but we were fortunate. We had one of the past Grand Masters came and put on a program for the Masons and Lodge, and we had a dinner and everything. But he actually went through a history of all the different places that Montgomery Lodge met in the town of Salisbury.
And where were the various places that they met?
Well, they actually met in the town hall at once upon a time for a while. They met in what used to be the Lime Rock Lodge, which was an apartment house down in Lime Rock. There's the Bushnell Tavern, which is adjacent to the Salisbury Town Hall now. That used to be the Bushnell Tavern. We met there. There's where the Boathouse Restaurant is now. That used to be a three-story building. They used to meet upstairs in that.
Yep.
When I referred to Bicentennial Park, that's basically that's the foundation base of a building that the lodge met in upstairs in that building, too. So that's just a few of them. There's probably 9 or 10 places, and I can't recall all of them. But
Bicentennial Park, would that be where the Holly Block was?
It's...
No. Where's Bicentennial Park? Is it...
Centennial Park. It's the park adjacent to Founders Insurance building.
That's where the Holly Block used to be.
The Holly Block, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got to get these specifics.
Right.
Did they ever meet at the Methodist Church?
I don't think so.
Okay. Just checking. How many members do you have now in Lodge?
Well, right now, there's... my phone.
Okay.
Right now, I have... I think it's 56 members now. I actually serve as secretary of the lodge right now, so that's why I have that number in my head. So.
Oh, good. Now, you've told me that the lodge has had to consolidate. Can you go through...
Sure. I think I want to say 1996, the lodge in Sharon, which was Hamilton Lodge, was losing members and really wasn't being active. And the Grand Master, they sort of folded up, and the Grand Master assigned the Brothers of Hamilton Lodge, number 54 from Sharon, to actually merge with Montgomery Lodge. And then, I'm trying to remember the year, maybe... I'd have to look up the year, but the lot Blazing Star number 74 from Cornwall voted to surrender their charter, they call it, and they merged. They voted to merge Montgomery Lodge number 13 in Lakeville. So basically, when I first got in the lodge, each lodge had its own area that they were that if people lived in there were supposed to join that lodge, or they would get what they call release of jurisdiction. Like if when I got in to belong to Montgomery Lodge, you lived either in Salisbury, Lakeville, or Falls Village.
I see.
But, like if you lived in Canaan, you had to get
You
had to get release of jurisdiction if you wanted to join Lakeville. Since then, the Grand Lodge has passed an edict or passed ruling that as long as you live in Connecticut, you can join any lodge in Connecticut. You don't have to be in a certain town.
So it's no longer area specific. You can join wherever you want.
It's just state
specific. State specific. Okay.
So saying that, we've had quite a few applicants in recent year and a half or so from Great Barrington, Mass, who actually want to join with us. So what we have to do is get release of jurisdiction through our Grand Lodge Secretary and Grand Master. They send a letter to the Grand Lodge of Massachusetts to grant them release of jurisdiction for them to join with us. So, and actually, it's a coincidence, we're having a special, they call it special communication, special meeting this coming Saturday, and there's two from Massachusetts who are actually going to take their first degree this coming Saturday.
How many degrees are there?
There's 3 degrees. Any Mason has to be... a third-degree Mason is considered a Master Mason. The 3 degrees are Entered Apprentice, Fellow, Craft, and then Master Mason. All Masons are Master Masons.
I see.
You can go on and become and go through more degrees, but all Masons are considered equal and they're all Master Masons. They all meet on the level, and just because you go on and become, you know, through different ranks and become, even go into the Grand Lodge and become become what they call a most worshipful grandmaster, mm-hmm. you're still a brother first.
Oh, sure.
Everybody's introduced as brother.
Okay.
And then you say their title, but everybody's equal.
Everybody's equal. I like that.
Yeah.
I like that. But no women allowed.
That's correct. It's Order of Eastern Star.
It's the
female branch of mm-hmm. the Masonic fraternity.
Like it was used to be in Rotary. It was all male in Rotary. And
okay.
The wives weren't part of it, and then
yeah.
they loosened up, I guess. Tell me about Dwight Coles. He had a position in the Masons.
Well, Dwight Coles was a past master. Dwight Coles was real good personal friends with my grandfather, Jake mm-hmm. Fitting, and Dwight had a cottage up on Twin Lakes. And I remember going up to his house a number of times when I was younger, and go fishing and just go out on the boat with Dwight. But when we had our 200th anniversary, I tried to contact Dwight Coles, who had actually moved to Georgia mm-hmm. at the time, and tried to contact him because what I wanted to do for our special meeting we had for the 200th anniversary was have all the living past masters sit in the principal chairs of the lodge,
Ooh.
Which I was able to do, except Dwight couldn't make it up. So
Who else did you have?
So we had Ken Athol.
Oh, good.
Was sat in the east, and you know what, I can't remember until I look back in the records, but
that's okay.
But that was, you know, a few of the older ones we tried to get, or I made an endeavor to get to sit in the principal chair. So.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
That they were honored, even though they've done other things
right.
and gone on. Oh, that's lovely. I'm now going to talk about the fire district, because...
The fire department?
No, the fire district. What's the fire district?
Okay, well...
It's no longer. It used to be.
Right. The Lakeville Fire District... was a taxing authority in the center of Lakeville, and it had boundaries, and I think it was named that, well, mainly because the fire company equipment was owned by the fire district, but they also maintained the sewers and the water lines and the sidewalks in the center of Lakeville, and they, like I say, they were their own taxing authority, and they had their own charter. As progress caused to happen, if you will, the sewers were expanded, but basically there's now a Water Pollution Control Authority which manages the sewers for the whole town of Salisbury and expanded into the village of Salisbury instead of just the center of Lakeville. And then the water company actually, as far as that fee was actually relinquished on to the Aquarian Water Company, or well, before that, it was Lakeville Water Company.
Yeah, and then they were bought out by the Aquarian.
That's correct. So then it got to be just the fire district only owned, basically owned the firehouse and the fire equipment and took care of the sidewalks. And it just got to be an extra tax for the people living there. And so I know there was a few who were real adamant about trying to dissolve it for a long time. And, mm-hmm. And it finally happened when there was the creation of the... what is now the Salisbury Fire Commission, and basically the fire district dissolved, and the fire equipment was turned over to the Lakeville Hose Company, which has its own charter too. So.
And this all happened with the new firehouse being built.
Yes. That's,
okay. So that would be 2009.
Yes, 2009.
Now we're going to talk about the fire company, the Lakeville Hose
right.
Company. Do you know when it was founded?
1905.
Why?
There was a historic fire in the center of Salisbury, and basically it burned down, you know, I can't tell you how many buildings now, but the whole center of
Just
Salisbury
about the
burned
whole center.
Burned to the ground. The and went from what's the Academy building, which still stands now, mm-hmm. all the way down to the Episcopal Church.
Yep.
So, and there was a history about them calling in the fire brigade from Millerton, and how horses ran. What's the word I want to say? But basically, dead beaten, mm-hmm. and one of the horses actually, after it got there, they had put it down
because it, yeah.
Yeah. So
I had a little bit of that from Lila Nash, who was born across the street, and her mother said that the fire was so hot that she couldn't put her hand on the windows.
Oh, really?
So yeah. You know that's why I was asking you that specifically. Yeah. Now they own the fire equipment. They didn't used to, but now they own the fire equipment.
Yeah, and that's more just for title purposes with the motor vehicles, etc. So the fire company has its own charter, I guess, so we own our own equipment. The firehouse is actually owned by the town of Salisbury now, and the fire department has a lease on it.
Now, the old firehouse is where? The old one.
That's... You mean the original one? Yeah, number 41. So the little white building adjacent to the brick building, which is number 9 Sharon Road. Used to be 9 Montgomery Street.
Yes.
So
that used to be Bill Rainsford's
carpentry shop. Yes.
Carpentry shop.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So that's where the old firehouse is.
Yeah.
Where is the new firehouse?
The new firehouse location is actually 4 Brook Street is the address.
And that's off Route 44.
That's off Route 44 or 41. And that used to be, it was a plastics factory immediately prior to...
LPM, Lakeville Precision Molding.
Yeah.
And that
was changed to ITW.
Yes, it was changed to ITW, right. And then it became what we now know as the new fire building.
Correct.
The reason I'm being specific is somebody reading this 20 years from now needs to know the locations.
Right. Okay.
You know, and I know, but... Now, you are also fire marshal?
Yes.
And what's that job?
Okay. As fire marshal, the duties of a fire marshal, this is by Connecticut General Statutes, the duties of a fire marshal are to inspect all buildings with the exception of 1 or 2 family dwellings. It used to be once a year, but they've sort of put a time schedule on, depending on the use of the buildings, but... you inspect public buildings to make sure they're safe for people to be in, there's safe ways out, there's proper alarm systems and or fire protection systems if needed, if required by the code. Just make sure they're safe for people to be in. The fire marshal also issues blasting permits, fireworks permits. I'm going to go back to inspecting buildings. Any building with a liquor license needs a fire marshal's approval for use. That's an annual inspection. And that, as well as you have to investigate the cause and origin of all fires and determine and write a report if necessary and satisfy the needs of insurance companies. We are fortunate in the state of Connecticut to have a very active and source called the State Fire Marshal's Office. So if there's a major fire, you can call in the State Fire Marshal's Office, which are a division of the Connecticut State Police. So if it is, I'm going to say arson fires or fires of questionable reason, you have access to people with authority of power of arrest, and actually they have access to more technology for investigation purposes.
Did they come in when the Salisbury Town Hall burned?
Yes, yes.
And that would have been 85?
85, yeah.
85.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I actually, that was before I was fire marshal. So, yeah, I was my wife and I and my youngest daughter, we had her first birthday on August 1st of that year. We were in Nantucket when that happened, so.
Oh, goodness.
We came back.
How did you get the job of fire marshal? Do you have to apply for it, or?
Yeah, the only way you can become a fire marshal is you have to take when I took it, it was a 120-hour course. You have to have a letter of appointment, which says, basically, you can only take the course if you have this letter that you will be appointed if you successfully complete the course. So at the time, the appointing authority for the town of Salisbury is the Board of Selectmen. And So I started, when I started, there was 40 when we started the class, and there was only 30 that graduated, so 10 dropped out halfway through. They just couldn't make it. So that's the way you become fire marshal. You have to have a letter of appointment before you can even take the course.
When did you become fire marshal?
I completed the course in 1988, and I was appointed, I think it was January. So your calendar, your time calendar starts, I was appointed January 6, 1989. At a selectman's meeting, so the date of your appointment is when your clock starts.
Who was the fire marshal before you?
Immediately before me was David Hall. He was there for a couple years. He took over right after George Bushnell, who was my uncle. George was a fire marshal for quite a few years before.
Oh, yeah.
Before George, it was Henry Rossier. I think before Henry, it was George Cleveland.
Probably.
And that's when it started. I think George was the first one.
Oh, okay. That name comes up a lot.
Yeah.
Cleveland. Building inspector. All right, let's talk about that one.
Okay. So when I became fire marshal, I worked for the town as a part-time position. And then I worked somewhat with Peter Oliver, who was a building inspector, and he wondered if I wanted to go full-time for the town and become assistant building inspector and fire marshal. So let me go back a little bit. Prior to these positions, I worked for myself as a contractor. Mm-hmm. And when I times were getting a little tight and some of the people I was working with, I couldn't depend on them, and I thought it was an opportunity to have some steady income, especially if you're trying to raise a young family.
Oh, yes.
So I took that on, and so I went full-time for the town as assistant building inspector and fire marshal. And that would have been in 1991 when I started full-time for the town. And then in 1994, the selectman at that time asked if I wanted to become building inspector, full-time building inspector. And I said, not really, but he said, well, why don't you? I said, well, I have to pass the exam. Because to become a building inspector, there isn't a class to take. You just have to pass an exam. So that's because Peter Oliver and Buddy Trotter didn't get along too good and didn't see eye to eye. So that's where that's how I became building inspector, because I took the exam and passed it. And so then I was appointed as building inspector and fire marshal.
And you had some on-the-job training, too.
Yes. You know.
Which makes a great deal of difference when you're taking an exam.
Well, the other part is, too, I had experience in construction because I did a lot of it, you know, through my life. That helped a lot, too.
Sure, because you would have knowledge that's different from book learning.
That's right, exactly.
And sometimes the knowledge is a lot better than book learning. I'm going to go back, and how have the codes changed over the years? Because I know they've changed quite a lot.
Well, the codes are developed, I guess I want to say, because of accidents, because of instances that they relate to. In some cases, the codes have relaxed because they've realized that some of them are too stringent. But for the most part, they do get more and more onerous, if you will. Mm-hmm. The big thing we're going through right now, and it's a learning experience for everybody, inspectors as well as the tradespeople out there, but the state's adopted a new energy code, and so there's a lot of learning with that, both interpretation of what it's saying and understanding it, and then learning how to apply it to make sense out in the field.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so we all can work together. One of the other big things that I think is happening, and I feel comfortable with it, is that I know the contractors used to say, you know, look out, we do this before the building inspector comes, or, you know, they never want to see him. And I think that's sort of
gotten
to a more comfortable thing, because we're all working together. It's to make for a safe environment and to protect the homeowners and the contractors mm-hmm. alike, because it's as much about liabilities anymore as it is safety. Because
and it's a win-win situation if everybody works together.
Yeah.
You know, and that's important.
It sure is. Yeah.
You've got a lot of responsibility with those two jobs. A tremendous amount of responsibility.
you do, and sometimes it makes it difficult to try to enjoy life, if you will.
Yes.
Because I know I tend to go into places, and if it's too crowded, I'll get nervous, and especially if I know it shouldn't be.
Yeah.
For the most part, people understand. A good example is one thing that happened right over here at the Congregational Church with our new pastor, but they had an assembly program in the back hall set up, and they had a piano moved up right in front of the exit door, and they told her she couldn't do that, and which, you know, they just don't pay attention to it. And she jumped right on board, and she put a siren on the door. All I know of that, plus they had the curtains pulled across it. And so she put a siren on the door. She understood what I was saying, and just posted now, and you know, not to block the door and not to pull the curtains. But it's educating people, too.
And that makes a lot of difference, because if people understand where you're coming from, they're not going to argue about it.
Yeah.
And that helps, because then people are far more cooperative, I would think.
In a small town, what makes it difficult is when you know everybody. And
yes.
I know I went to a gathering of people after there was a fundraising dinner raise, and somebody said to me, come on down to this certain place and have a beer. And I said, okay, I'll come for one beer. But I walked in there, and I had a beer, and the place was packed.
Uh-huh.
And there's actually, this hadn't come into effect yet, but there's actually a law in effect now that a fire marshal can actually have somebody arrested. Mm-hmm. And so, anyhow, this place was packed, and I had a beer, and I said, okay, thank you. And the guy said, come on, one more. I said, no, I told you I'm having one beer, and I walked out. But it was one of the things that I wasn't sure how I was going to handle it about going up to this business in town, small business, and they, you know, everybody needs money when they can make it, and they had an opportunity.
And so you, instead of getting into a confrontational situation, just chose to withdraw yourself from it.
Yeah, and probably, I guess this, I'm going to ask you that, so, but one of the things that could happen there, had something happened in that place and I was aware of it, it would have been real disastrous, because it's one of those things, should you do something about it? You know?
Yeah, it's a very iffy situation. And because you do know everybody, there's a lot of emotion and sensitivity that if you were, say, up in Lenox, you wouldn't have the same feelings.
Exactly.
You
know, exactly.
You letter of the law rather than the essence of the law, which makes a difference. Now, you said that you were a contractor. Who are some of the people that you worked with? Did you work for, or did you have your own business?
Well,
or
when I was, let's see, was I 16? I worked after schools when I was, I guess, 15 or 16. I worked at the Connecticut Yankee, which was a gift clothing shop here in Salisbury, and I made up packing boxes so they could ship.
Salisbury or Lakeville?
Salisbury. The Connecticut Yankees wear the
passports. Now.
What is it now?
Passports?
Yes. Is that it?
I think so.
Yeah. It's
okay.
The White Building before the Episcopal Church.
Right. Because Connecticut Yankee used to be down in Lakeville. Bob Darden's men's shop.
Oh, it's before that.
Okay.
It was before that.
Okay.
So, anyhow, and then, so I was going to high school, and then Dale Palmer said to his dad, which I found out when he wrote in the yearbook, he said to his dad, come on, hire Mike, he's a good worker. So Dale Palmer, his father's name was Dale, he was a mason contractor, and I went to work for him. You know what, I'm going to take that back a minute, too. I want to go back to when I was, I guess when I was 15, I worked for the summer with my grandfather, who was a carpenter. So I remember he paid me $1 an hour.
And, would that have been
Jake Fitting?
Good wages.
He paid me $1 an hour, and I remember he always paid with a pay envelope. And you got a.
Oh, good.
You know, you always had the cash in the envelope. And I remember the last weekend we knocked off on Friday noon because we were going to go to with my grandfather, my brother, and I were going to go to Long Island. But he still paid me that $40. I thought, how can he do that, you know?
Oh.
I still got like $40.
Gee, but that's a good experience.
So anyhow, then back to, so then I was working at Tank Yankee, and then Dale Palmer told his father that he ought to hire Mike, and anybody wrote in the yearbook was, you know, here I had worked mason work all my life. I grew up around it. He said, and I just had to bust my ass to stay one step ahead of you.
Yeah.
So he taught me how to work, you know, good hard work, but you also learn how to work, and work smart instead of working all bull work.
Yeah. You learn the tricks of the trade.
Yeah. So then, and after that, so I worked for him summers and then went to work full-time for him. And then when I got laid off in the winter, I collected unemployment 1 year. But then after that, he actually merged with his business with the McTerry Corporation. So I worked with them for a couple of years. And then I'm trying to think how it went after that. I went to work for, Larry Hogan and I went in business together. Larry Hogan's another guy a year older than me in town. And he was a carpenter. And we worked together. And we actually formed a partnership. We worked for a few years together. And then we had a falling out. Young guys are tend to do that. So after that, I went to work with a gentleman named Dick Barzin, who built tech-built homes. And that was a modular-type home.
And his name was what again?
Dick Barzin, B-A-R-Z-I-N.
Okay, all right.
And I worked for him for a few years. And then he actually took his business and actually went in with Richard A. Snyder Construction, which was a big company on Belleville Road in Lakeville. And because he had a big crew, because they had carpenters and plumbers and electricians and did a little bit of everything. So I worked for them for quite a few years. And I might have that mixed up. When did I go to work for? Oh, that's right. And then after that, I just went out on my own with another guy who worked for Dick Snyder. Mm-hmm. We were both working with each other, and we just sort of did jobs. This other gentleman, Bill Hopkins, he lived in Millerton, New York. I worked some jobs with him, he worked some jobs with me. We each had our own businesses.
And it was basically wood construction. It wasn't walls or fireplaces or things like
that. No, basically carpentry.
Carpentry, okay.
Oh, and good. A little bit of what they call flat work. I did concrete floors and stuff like that.
But nothing like mortaring chimneys or
no,
walls.
No, I didn't get into that.
No.
I did it when I worked for Dale Palmer, but I didn't do it. Actually, when I worked for Dale Palmer, we built what's the building that's McLean Ford now. We built
that. Oh, my word.
Yeah. So that's, it was Turney Ford then.
Yes, it was.
And
yes,
we
it
built
was.
That building.
Good
over in Millerton. Yeah.
You had something to do with SWASA, too, I think.
Well, I never joined SWASA, Salisbury Winter Sports, Salisbury Winter Sports Association. But I've been active with them and helped out in the food shack for probably 35 years, if not a little more than that. So, and it just always helped out down there and given it my all just to help another local volunteer organization in town.
Who were some of the people that worked at the food shack? I think you mentioned a miner.
Okay, when I first started working in the food shack, George and Martha Miner actually took care of that then. And then after that, I think after that it was Chris and Sue Dakin did it.
Yeah.
And then Dave Heck did it for a couple of years. Dave and Peggy Heck. Then Kenny Lacko did it for quite a few years. And since then it's been Mary Olette, and she's done it ever since then.
And she's the wife of the state police.
Yeah,
trooper.
Charlie Olette. He used to be resident trooper here.
Right. Okay. Is there anything that I haven't asked you that you'd like to add?
It's funny how you think of stuff as you go along.
I know.
And then you try to recall it again. I guess one of the big things is growing up in town, I'm fortunate that it was a small town it was, and it's a lot different now, of course. You know, it used to be when we get a snowstorm and school wasn't called as often as it is nowadays.
Oh, yeah.
But I'd grab a shovel and I'd run downtown because I had people that they would shovel their path for it. I'd get 50 cents or a dollar here or there, and then, of course, then we got done, we'd always go have one of those root beer floats.
Oh, yeah.
Or we'd go to the drugstore and hang out. But, the kids don't do that anymore, you know.
I have a neighborhood boy who comes down and shovels my walk, but he doesn't want money, he wants cookies.
Yeah.
And the last time he shoveled for me, he got 9 cookies, because it was a big job.
Wow, yeah.
There are still, Chatfield Hill is one of them, there are still streets where everybody looks out for everybody else.
That's good. Yeah. So,